everybody, it's Diane Rehm. On my mind this week, a recent column by David Brooks in the New York Times. He wrote about the economic and cultural trends in this country that led to the Trump presidency and where they're taking us now.
First, you got this lower growth. And when that happens, it's a zero-sum mentality. If you get some, that means I don't get some. And that's how Donald Trump talks. He talks in very zero-sum terms.
Then, later on, from the archives, two of my heroes.
Oh, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier.
You don't even know what I am, Dad. You don't know who I am. You don't know how I feel, what I think. And if I try to explain it the rest of your life, you will never understand.
But let's begin with David Brooks. David, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you again. We have a lot of years under our belts doing
Absolutely.
This sort of thing.
You and I both. You and I grew up in an age of optimism. As you said in a column recently, no world wars, no great depressions. But what do you see happening in this, the 21st century?
Yeah, I guess I have a little darker view of this century. In retrospect, we were pretty fortunate. The Cold War was happening. There was a lot of stuff going on in the 20th century. But when you think of the first half of the 20th century or the 19th century, the Civil War and all that, last half was pretty good, pretty well governed overall. But now I think the 21st century began on 9/11 and has continued with nationalism, with a decline in democracy the last 10 years. According to Freedom House, democracies have been in retreat. Authoritarianism has been on the rise. And sectarianism, a division of within the EU, greater political divisions within the United States, and slower growth. And one of the things I wrote about recently was a very nice essay by Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute, pointing out in the 15 years before 2000, growth was about 2.3% a year. And now it's about 1.1% per capita. And that's even after the financial crisis. And so when growth gets slower, everybody starts grabbing for the pie and they get a little less generous.
Little less generous and creating less optimism. But what does that do to the population at large when that growth slows down? Donald Trump has said he inherited a mess.
At home and abroad, a mess. Jobs are pouring out of the country. You see what's going on with all of the companies leaving our country, going to Mexico and other places.
And he's talking about wages, financially as well as every other way.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a mess as much as the new normal. I mean, by some measures, the economy is doing okay. The unemployment rate is okay. But I think the stock market is going gangbusters. But one of the things Eberstadt points out is first you got this lower growth, which means, and when that happens, it's a zero-sum mentality. If you get some, that means I don't get some. And that's how Donald Trump talks. He talks in very zero-sum terms. The second, people are much more less likely to support big social programs. There's a Harvard professor named Benjamin Friedman who said when you look at the big expansions of provision for people, they tend to be in pretty strong growth eras, the 1960s being the classic example. And third, you just get people looking to find dignity in other ways. If you can't find dignity because you feel you're doing well on the job or your prospects are increasing, your dignity comes from your ethnic nationalism or some other way that is often leads to darker passions.
When you think of a dissolving world order, when you think about that economically, politically, socially, where do you see the 21st century headed?
Yeah, well, I should say it's not baked in the cake. We get to make choices
yes,
in this world.
Yes, we do.
But I wasn't always a big fan of everything the European Union did. I thought sometimes they were a little removed from the people, but they did secure the peace in Europe for a half century so far. And I'm not always a fan of some of our big international alliances, but the U.S.-led international order has created a space for free trade and the free movement of people that has led to the greatest reduction of poverty in human history, a lot of it in Asia, a lot of it in Latin America. And so that's to be celebrated. And I come from a philosophical tradition that believes that the crust of civility is sometimes a thin crust, and that humans are capable of some pretty rotten things. And when you take away the little habits of order that we all built in, when you take away the United States, which sort of kept some of the bad guys at bay, then people can get pretty nasty pretty fast. And you could see the Vladimir Putins of the world and a lot of other people sort of beginning to chip away and chip away and chip away and incite, stumble into conflict. And I guess that's what I really worry about with the current president. Not so much that he has great designs of conflict, but he gets his ego up, his male ego, I should say, and we get into sort of a war of insecurities, a war of bullies.
There are many people showing up at town hall meetings around the country. You've seen the exchanges, if I can call them that, between our elected representatives and the people who show up. Pretty nasty stuff going on.
Yeah, and I, you know, I sometimes sympathize with the causes of the people who are showing up at the town hall meetings, but I never think there's an excuse for shouting down people. Our democracy is based on the idea of conversation and deliberation, and I think you do your own party and your own cause harm when you shout down and don't let a meeting happen. I just happened to be reading on the plane up here a Martin Luther King essay where he says, you know, we've got to make sure we don't fall into the same traps of our enemies or our opponents, of stereotyping people, of generalizing. And he said all those people who want to preserve segregation, they take a view that we find abhorrent, but they're individuals, and we should treat them as individual people who are struggling with their lives and not make these stereotypical generalizations about how evil they all are. And he was talking to his own people, his own troops. And I think that's a good thing to remind ourselves. And my view, and especially true in the Trump era, I'm not a fan of Trump, but I try never to castigate the Trump voters. I think he's the wrong answer to the right question.
You say in one of your columns, ours is not to resist Donald Trump. And then a quote, you say, he'll seal his own fate. How do you think he's going to do that?
Yeah, I thought that all along. It just doesn't look to me like a sustainable proposition, this administration. I don't think it's particularly well run. I don't think his character is particularly stable, and I do believe character is destiny. And so there are a lot of ways I could see him sort of undoing his administration. One with a corruption scandal that leads to a massive loss of support in something like impeachment hearings or a resignation. Two, just general dysfunction. The whole government stops working. Third, and the most scary to me, is the possibility that we get in a global conflict of some sort. He gets furious at Putin or whoever, and he gives the military some order they find abhorrently destabilizing and insane. And they say, I'm sorry, Mr. President, we're not going to do that. And then we have a crisis of civil-military relations. And I don't know what would happen then, but it would be a big mess.
Do you think he's capable of creating that kind of mess?
I certainly do. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's necessarily going to happen. I have hope for all people and for that people will learn to do the job. And I have to say, overall, his level of appointments, including
he's
the new one.
He's picked some good people.
Yeah, and he's surpassed my expectations by far, including Mr. McMaster. And so maybe that'll be a source of stability. But we hear stories from out of the White House of how he's managing meetings, of the information he doesn't know and doesn't seem interested in knowing, of dysfunctional decision-making, of policy advisors going in there and him getting bored after 7 minutes, of people within the administration deciding, well, maybe if we can want him to absorb some information, we can package it as a cable TV show and he'll watch it. And so they're trying to think ways to work around his lack of attention to detail. And when I see someone who I think has an unstable character and less than adequate information about how to run a very complicated job, I somehow don't think it's sustainable. Though, to be fair, I have trouble exactly seeing how it stops.
David, how do you get your information? Do people on the inside who are as concerned as you are, are they telling you these stories?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. It's funny, I've been doing this since Reagan and in every other administration, Democratic, Republican, I had a lot of good direct contacts with each administration, including usually with the president. This time, I don't have that kind of access. I've been so critical of the President Trump. So I haven't had that too much, though I'm maybe about to get some more. But we certainly have friends, and if you've been in the realm of governance or Republican governance, you certainly know people who've been hired into the government, and you know people who know people. And so through those back channel confidential sources, people have been quite quick to talk about what's going on inside, people who were supporting Trump in general.
How do you think the Republican Party is being affected by Trump?
Well, I mean, it should be said that Trump is not popular, judging by Gallup and Pew. His approval rating is about 39. But among Republicans, his approval rating is 83. He's more popular with the Republicans than Ronald Reagan was at this time. And so when I talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, I do not see them pulling away from Donald Trump. They have their own private concerns, but their Republican base is very locked in right now. That may or may not last, but it's the case right now. So Republicans are not moving, but they're shifting with him. And so he's a person who's opposed a lot of the policies Republicans have normally stood for: free trade, internationalism, hostility to tyranny around the world. And they're shifting with the man. And the poll I saw yesterday was, what do you think of Vladimir Putin? About a year ago, only like 12% of Republicans had any positive view of Vladimir Putin. Now like 39% have a positive view of Vladimir Putin. People do what their leader tells them to do in a partisan world.
What effect do you think Vladimir Putin and his thinking, his approach, his actions toward his own people is having on the mind of Donald Trump?
Yeah. Well, I think two things. One, that Trump, or at least people around him, look at Putin and see he's a strong traditionalist. He's against the global order. He's against NATO. He's against all the things we're against. He's informed by philosophers. There's a guy named Alexander Dugin in Russia who thinks the way we do, that this is a world of ethnic nation states, and we have to protect the ethnic purity of our country. And so that's a philosophical grounding that they share. But then, you know, I've always been curious because obviously Trump has been very nice to Putin. But we know in Russia, and Putin experts will tell you this, there's one thing about the guy, that he is a risk taker. And he's always pushing the envelope, always looking to see what he can get away with. And as the U.S. seems less powerful, he's going to be pushing a little harder. And one of the things that I've noticed over the last week is that the Russian media has gone very hostile toward Trump all of a sudden after being very friendly. And is that because people in the Trump administration said critical things about Crimea? Possibly. But it could be we're about likely for a confrontation. And I've long thought these two big egos can't play in the same sandbox without fighting at some point. And I do think that's a likely flashpoint.
Taking risks is something that you argue fewer people in this country are willing to do. Taking risks economically, entrepreneurially. What's happened to the psyche in this country?
I went back once and read a book that was written in 1910, and it was about who are Americans? What is the essence of America? And this book said right there in the first sentence, it's energy. Americans are just a very energetic people in good ways and bad. We marry and divorce more. We kill each other more. But we also start more companies. And so there's just a lot of dynamism. And I think that has been the saving grace. Whatever mistakes we make, at least we have the energy to fix them, potentially. But one of the things that has worried me foundationally is that signs of energy are declining. Mobility. We used to move, so much more frequently than anybody else in the world. Mobility, moving across states, is down massively over the last few decades. And it's not because we're an aging population. The millennials are less likely to move than anybody else, or at least much less likely than earlier younger generations.
But can't that be seen as a positive? In other words, they want to be where their foundations are.
Yeah, and that does mean that one is more likely to have good roots. But If you want to transform your life and sometimes learn new things, sometimes moving, especially in your 20s and 30s, is a good way to expand your horizons. And strictly on economic terms, they've done a lot of research into this, and strictly on economic terms, people who move do better over their lifetimes financially.
You know, you make me think of the people of Appalachia who have been used to coal mining all their lives. I watched a piece on the news hour recently where a young man raising a young family said, all my life I've wanted to be in the mines, and Trump has promised we're going to go back to bring out more coal.
Yeah.
How is he going to keep that promise?
Well, I think he'd have to ban the natural gas industry. I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think it's a myth and a cruel myth to tell people that they can stay in those places and they're going to find jobs there. It's just been a flow of jobs outside of places like West Virginia, or not a coal territory, but Upper New York State, Central Pennsylvania. You know, in my view, one of the things government should do is give people moving vouchers. Give them vouchers, and this is something I think Mitt Romney once proposed, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, and say, you know, there are a lot of jobs in Houston. There's a lot of jobs in Denver and Phoenix. If you want to go out there, here's a little help to get there. And that would be good for a lot of families over the long term. You strain communities, but America is about moving to opportunity. And one of the things we've learned from the research at Harvard and elsewhere is the powerful effect of neighborhood. And if you're in a neighborhood, whether it's an inner city neighborhood or a rural poor neighborhood, it's just very hard to make it. And, you know, I've spent a lot of the last year in neighborhoods exactly like that, especially rural poverty. And, you know, you go to a lot of places and there are no jobs and the diners are closed and the stores downtown are boarded up and the opiate use is massive. Yeah, you see that everywhere. In Ohio, I saw the statistic recently that in 1 3-month period, 11% of Ohioans were prescribed opiates. And so you just find opiate use everywhere. I ran into a guy in West Virginia about 6 months ago. He has a ceramics plant. And so the people who work there have to use heavy equipment. And so he has to give him a drug test. You can't be on drugs and be using this equipment. And he said, I'll get 100 people to get some jobs, and I'll tell them they're going to have drug tests, and 50 don't show up. Because they know they're going to fail. Another 20 fail. And so out of that 100, he can only hire 3 or 4, in part because of drugs, in part because of other things. And so that's just a huge block to getting jobs.
You know, it makes me wonder whether the increasing use of opiates is generated by a certain amount of fear that there are no options.
Yeah.
So I'll close down.
Yeah, or isolation, social isolation. Somewhere I read a very good essay from somebody who was living in Ohio, and he said, you have to remember, opiate use is just a slow motion form of suicide. And it's lack of prospects, isolation, boredom, and then once you're on the opiates, it's super hard to get off them, obviously.
You wrote a column recently about Deb and Jim Fallows.
Yeah.
And how they are looking at different parts of the country and where you think the action may come from.
First, I should celebrate them as like this great couple when you go
they
see them.
They are terrific.
They've been writing together from China, from Japan. Now they're flying around the country.
Right.
And they share love. They share vocation. They share charm. They're an inspiring couple to be around.
They are indeed.
And so I looked at them, and what they've done over the course of their lives is moved to where the action is, to Japan in the 80s, to China about 12 years ago, and now they're flying around America to get the sense of the social fabric. And so I asked a question at a dinner party. It just came to me. If you were Jim and Deb Fallows and you wanted to go where the action is today, anywhere in the world, where would you go? I think I make the case for Washington that partly because of Donald Trump, the decisions made here will have a more important effect on the world than anywhere else, the decisions made anywhere else. And so I sort of make the case that sort of seeing what happens over here over the next couple of years is the center of gravity in the world right now. I could be wrong. You know, in the 90s, we would have said Silicon Valley. I was fortunate enough early in my career to be based in Europe and covering the decline of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, and I thought I was right at the center of the action there. The Middle East would have been a good spot to be in the 2000s. But I think Washington right now is the center of gravity. Jim sent me, a fellow sent me an email, and he said, no, I think being out in Fargo or Fresno, being out in the cities where they're actually solving problems is where you want to be.
Exactly. He says they are solving problems. Yeah. In these little ways, does that not give you a certain amount of optimism?
Yeah, when you go out. I was actually out at Fargo last week, and this morning I was in Atlanta with a community, a whole group of community leaders. I was in Indiana, Indianapolis, where they suffer some poverty problems. And whenever you go to a local place, you're just cheered up.
Yeah.
Because they, first of all, government feels normal. Like they talk to each other, they solve problems, they do stuff. And then the one thing that's so inspiring, wherever you go, there are community healers everywhere. And so yesterday I was in Atlanta and I met a guy who has founded this a friendship society where they take African Americans and whites and just create friends. We will be friends with each other. And another guy who creates these voluntary organizations for early childhood education, other things. And you meet so many people traveling around the country who are devoting their life and their time in some real way to healing the social fabric. And it's inspiring. And then sometimes you think, how come we still have all these problems? Because there's so many good people working really hard, but it's
a struggle. Because Washington is different. And, you know, I was in Florida last week, and it was so peaceful. It was so calm. And everybody seemed to be having a great time, totally mindless of or not thinking about what was going on. So it's hard to come back to Washington.
You really get a sense that a lot of things that obsess us are feel different in the country. But I will say, you know, I think Washington is filled with good people who are stuck in a bad system. And when I, you know, a lot of the people who work here now in Congress or wherever else, they were local leaders. And they came here because they wanted to make a difference on the national level.
So what's happened?
Well, I think there's a style of team partisan loyalty that divides everybody. There's the money chase. There's just the lack of habit of conversation that people slip into. The money is greater here. The media attention is greater here. I find a lot of people adopt a false mentality. You talk to members of Congress, sometimes they hate the things they have to say. But the way the team warfare works here, you got to be a total team player and say simple, stupid things in order to make your team happy. And a lot of them are very desperately unhappy doing that, but they try to be good team members.
And let's take a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Something I've wondered about is the Secretary of State. He has had a photograph taken, I gather, leaning over Donald Trump. He has not had a staff put in place. Was that photograph a deliberate show of lack of power on the Secretary of State?
It certainly seems that way. They haven't had a briefing, a State Department briefing in a while, because they apparently have no staff or nothing to brief. Second, you know, the key job, for especially a big job like Secretary of State, this is a major, major job, is you get to pick your own staff.
Yeah.
And he picked a man, Elliot Abrams, to be his number two, and somehow President Trump dumped him because he had said some critical things in the campaign. Well, Barack Obama ran against Hillary Clinton. They said a lot of really critical things about each other. And he still said, well, she's, you know, that was part of the campaign, and now we're moving on. And I think if Donald Trump wants to get good staff, he's just going to have to get rid of that loyalty test. One of the things that I think has been worrisome about this administration is that I forget exactly how many confirmable positions he has to fill, something like 691. And they haven't even named a nominee in 631 of those. So there's just, you know, you can imagine Rex Tillerson over there in the State Department building, you know, making the coffee, sweeping the floors. There's nobody else there to help him. And so it's hard to run an administration when you're just sitting alone in an office somewhere.
And in the meantime, you see the stock market going crazy.
Yeah.
How do you account for that?
Yeah, I have trouble. I guess there's one argument that he's a more or less normal Republican president, and he's going to reduce regulation, make life easier for business, and therefore it'll propose growth. That could be. But the counter argument is that he's a much more nationalist populist leader who, if he does anything, will make life more uncomfortable for big corporations. The third option, which I think is the most likely, is that he doesn't get a lot done either way. And we have an administration that just doesn't pass a lot of things. And to me, that's really the danger. The danger is not authoritarianism. The danger is passivity and anarchy, because we don't have people actually running a government. And, you know, I had once had a friend in the State Department say, you have to remember what we do here is not foreign affairs, it's foreign relations. A lot of what we do is just keep our relationships intact. And that's a daily activity. And if nobody's doing that, then things begin to slip apart.
You've said that there are no institutions in place that would normally take down a president. What do you mean?
Yeah, well, when we think of presidents resigning or getting impeached or whatever, we think of Watergate. And so you walk through what happened in Watergate. First of all, we had a very powerful Washington Post, and the Post and the Times could – there was one reality that all of America sort of subscribed to. And now the Post and the Times can be very critical or reveal very bad information for an administration. But Breitbart's out there, or a guy like Alex Jones is out there, who can live in a different reality universe. And so the support can stay very high. The second thing is what we had in Congress was a lot of moderates. And the epitome of this was Howard Baker of Tennessee, who played an important role in Watergate, and he's a Republican, but he was sort of – his loyalty to the institutions of the Senate and the institutions of the U.S. government were higher than his loyalty to the party. And so somebody like him or Sam Ervin, who was somebody could rise up and become a committee chairman, and they were going to do their jobs and put party affiliation sometimes second. And now it's hard to see people doing that, because party affiliation comes first and foremost over the institution very often.
So that means that party affiliation becomes far more important than loyalty to the nation as a whole.
Or even the way things have been done. One of the things I strongly support is this filibuster, the 60 vote. And that's not written in the Bible or anything. It's not sacred, but it's just the way we've done things. And I think if you have to get 60 votes, you have to pay a little attention to the other party. You can't just ram everything through with a slender majority. And what I've noticed as the Senate has gone back Democratic and Republican, whichever party is in the majority without the 60 votes, they want to get rid of the filibuster. They want to go to the so-called nuclear option. And nobody has any actual principles about this. It's just where they happen to sit at this moment. So their beliefs are purely opportunistic. But I would think if you would go back to Senator Robert Byrd and some of the other people who were really institutionalists, they had views about how the institution should run.
And always had a copy of the Constitution,
that's right, yeah,
in his pocket.
Exactly. And so that was part of the mindset that I've dedicated my life to this institution, and it should run well when I'm in the majority or when I'm in the minority. And it has a purpose. And one of the things that used to be very much in the minds of senators was, this is not the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives is meant to quickly reflect the American people and what they want at that moment. The Senate's supposed to sort of slow things down and be more deliberative. But now the Senate is sort of like the House, becoming a lot more like the House.
The amended refugee travel ban,
yeah.
They've taken out the word Muslim. And yet reporters have gone back and heard the president use Trump, use the word Muslim over and over again during the campaign. How is this going to proceed?
Yeah, my problem with the travel ban was, first, it does look like a Muslim ban. There are seven countries, they have Muslim countries. Second, there's just no basis for it. And this was part of the court decisions, that There has not been an instance in the last 15 years where a person from any of these seven countries murdered anybody in a terrorist act. So what's the harm here? And third, if you're going to take an action that's going to rile up the entire world against you and potentially offend Muslims around the world, there better be some good reason. So there's no good reason. It's just almost directly intended to offend members of one of the world's major religions. And so I judge it less on judicial grounds and constitutional grounds, more just on the realm of wisdom and justice. And, you know, if you want to tighten up our immigration system or you want to tighten up our refugee system, we'll find concrete ways to do it. But to target seven countries from one faith, well, you're just sending signals. You're not really governing.
Where do you think the Supreme Court will go on an issue like immigration, on an issue like abortion, once Neil Gorsuch enters the court?
Yeah, I it should be said I'm not a court watcher. I don't write about the courts there. I write about too much as it is. So I can write about, if I can tie off things I really don't know much about. The only thing I would observe is whatever side the justices are on, they tend to have some respect for precedent. And I think sometimes judges in the Supreme Court will make a big society-changing decision. But I just observe, as really a complete amateur, they tend not to like to be responsible for radically changing society. And that was the case in the Roberts Court, where they had a chance to overthrow the Obamacare, and they decided not to. And that's been the case time and time again, where they'll make a decision if they have to, but they'd rather not be the center of American governance, and they tend not to overthrow things. So if how you feel about Roe v. Wade, and I have trouble seeing them overturning something so baked into American society.
And, of course, all of this somehow reflects on the mental health of our president. Lots of people have commented on that. I know you're not a therapist, you're not a psychiatrist, you are a person who watches and listens. What do you hear and what do you think?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I observe about his language, there was a time when I was really studying his sentence structure, and he speaks in what psychologists call flights of ideas, where you have six words about an idea, and then that he says a word, and that word sparks off another six words, and then another, and it's all sort of doesn't all come together. And the pattern is he'll talk about a subject, and then he'll come back to himself and his political victory or something like that, and then there'll be another flight, and he'll come back to himself. And there is that attention span issue is, to me, a worrying one. When I look at most of the past presidents, certainly Obama, certainly George W. Bush, a great deal of self-discipline. And they had to have self-discipline because the presidency is a job of decision-making. People made fun of George W. Bush said, I'm the decider. But both he and Obama did something I found very telling. They would take visitors to their closets in the residence, and they would say, here are my suits. And they're all the same, basically. And the reason they're not making decisions about suits is because they have to make so many other decisions. They're being efficient and trying not to make decisions about things they don't absolutely have to make a decision about. So they wear the same boring sort of suit every day. But that's because they're trying to save brain power. And so, you know, the decisions only come to a president if they couldn't get settled at a lower level. And they're all super hard decisions, usually with bad options. And the ones I worry about, as I referred to earlier, and this was an interview Ben Rhodes, President Obama's foreign policy advisor, said, somebody asked him, what will surprise President Trump? And he said, the number of decisions that involve use of force, that something happens in Syria, something happens on the South China Sea, and there's just a decision, do we use force? And those are very careful decisions filled with uncertainty. How does he handle that pace of decision-making where you really have to sort of know what you're doing and you have to have some basic respect for stability?
David Brooks, I want to ask you one more question because as I've read your column through the years, it struck me that there's so much philosophy in those columns. It's not just politics and opinion. Yeah. How much philosophy did you study?
A fair bit. I still study it. My parents were academics, so I come from that's my family business. I went to a school I cherish called the University of Chicago.
Where my son went for his PhD in philosophy. And
so we read a lot of Plato. I think I did 16 papers on Thucydides. I read a lot of Hobbes.
So you did ancient philosophy
But up to the moment, up to Isaiah Berlin, up to a guy named Michael Oakeshott. I don't have the normal newspaper man's interest of just being on the cusp of the news every day. I like to take a few steps back. And I will say just one of the things I've observed about the internet is that we in the newspaper business used to be middle distance runners, where you'd observe an event and then write about it for 800 words. Now we're either sprinters, which is to say we're tweeting out rapidly, or marathoners, trying to step back and say, how does this all fit together? And I'm definitely more the marathoner type. I'm not a sprinter. And so when I write these two columns a week, I try to take something I've read, usually from a book of philosophy, and say, well, how does this help give us a new perspective on the stuff we're seeing every day?
David Brooks, I want to thank you for being here. I also want to congratulate you on your upcoming marriage.
Oh, thank you. That's even as the country's been in its struggles, I've been deliriously happy, so that's good.
I'm so glad for you. That's coming in April.
That is coming in April, yes. Thank you, Diane.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
As we congratulate David Brooks on his upcoming marriage, I also want to congratulate two extraordinary men, Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, both major figures in civil rights and Hollywood. They've been the best of friends nearly all their lives. Each celebrates his 90th birthday. First, Sidney Poitier, who left his home in Nassau to join a brother in Miami. He rebelled against the racism he found there. I spoke with him in the year 2000. Let's give a listen.
It must have been so difficult to leave your relatives, your parents. I mean, you were going off to be with your brother. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
What happened in Miami?
Well, when I got to Florida, it was on the books. It was written in the laws of the city, the laws of the state, the laws of the county, that I was expected to be and to function and to live as we were once described as two-thirds of a human being.
Mm.
And instantly what happened to me in Florida was that which I was on Cat Island, that self that I had developed on Cat Island, immediately said, wait, that's not me. The person you are requiring of me to be is not me. I am not that. You know, my father was not that, nor was my mother. My brothers and sisters were not that. So I let Florida know, as best I could, that I could not accommodate Florida's requirements of me.
Oh, island in the sun, built to me by my father's hand.
In 2003, I spoke with Harry Belafonte about the events of that era and about his passion for a free education for all.
There are two things that should be in the United States of America as a matter of right and should have long ago been part of our fabric of existence, and that is education should be completely free. Not a cost should be attributed to anybody who goes out to learn from the childhood until you get out of the university. And no health care need by any citizen in this country should cost citizens in this country anything. And if we can find $87 billion on a minute's notice to send to Baghdad and to Iraq to continue to further our mischief in that region, and to leave these kinds of issues here in America unattended, I refuse to believe that we do not have the financial and the economic resource and the wherewithal to treat our citizens to a very fair and open and a democratic health care and educational system.
Both of these interviews are in the archives at drshow.org. So that's what's on my mind for this week. As always, we want to hear from you. Find us at Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or leave a voice memo at 202-854-8851. Tell us what's on your mind. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks, and talk to you next week.